Welcome to Historically Thinking, a program devoted to all kinds of historical knowledge and to the ways that we achieve it. I'm your host, Al Zambone, of the Department of History at Augustana College. Our website is historicallythinking.org, where you can subscribe, find more information about our guests, links, and related readings. Our email address is mail@historicallythinking.org. We'd love to hear from you. Hello. In the beginning, the universe was tiny, perhaps smaller than an atom. The temperature of this atom-sized universe was many trillions of degrees. At this temperature, matter and energy are interchangeable. As Einstein showed, matter is really little more than a congealed form of energy. Here, in this fantastically dense flux of energy matter, we come close to the primordial chaos of so many traditional creation myths. This might sound like the beginning of a popular book on science or cosmology written by someone named Sagan or perhaps Dawkins, but it's a quote from historian David Christian's Maps of Time, a pioneering work of big history. There's no one better to talk with about big history, to explain big history's history and what problems it addresses, than Craig Benjamin. He is the current president of the World History Society for 2 more weeks and associate professor of history at Grand Valley State University. He was literally present at the creation of the International Big History Association. There's a photo of his on his Wikipedia page to prove it. Craig, thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Al. It's a pleasure to be here.
What's your 2-minute elevator speech on big history? How would you describe big history in a very small space?
Big history, as that quote from David just touched upon, is really the modern creation story. David provocatively called it the modern creation myth. But it's really a creation story for the 21st century. It uses the most recent scientific, social science, and historical knowledge to tell the story of the origins of the universe, the history of the universe, the creation of all the more complex elements in the universe, the creation of our own solar system and planet, and, of course, the creation of life on this planet and of humans. And after that, it sort of tells the story of humans on a similarly macro scale, dividing human history into just 2 or 3 key sort of periods or eras. And it ends by considering the future on the scale of 100 years, 1,000 years, even billions of years from now. So this is very much the modern version of all the creation stories that have been so familiar to virtually every culture since humans appeared on this planet.
Well, that's very brisk, and that is an excellent elevator speech, I have to say. This is such a new field of inquiry. We have to be unavoidably autobiographical. How you were there, as I said, present at the creation of this International Big History Association. How did you come upon this? I mean, how did David Christian come upon this? His book is now, Maps of Time is how old? It's, what, 10
Maps
years
Maps of Time's probably been around for about 10 years now as a published book.
Right.
But before that, it was a manuscript that we were using in classrooms in Australia. Long before it was published.
Samizdat. It was bootleg. Yeah. A bootleg man. Okay. All right.
Very happy to give you some background here. David Christian is a Russian historian by training, educated at Oxford University, did his PhD on the sort of the Duma, the early 20th century Russian parliament that sort of functioned so badly before the Bolshevik Revolution. Through that interest, he became increasingly interested in Russian history and sort of inner Eurasian history more generally. And I was at Macquarie University in Sydney where David was teaching, and I was sort of one of those non-traditional students who'd gone back to university in his 30s. And almost by accident, I found myself doing a PhD in ancient history. I had an entirely different sort of job. I was actually a jazz musician playing music for a living for about a quarter of a century. But I became increasingly interested in, I was mostly focused on Roman history, how far Roman cultural influence was spreading into Central Asia. I was sort of vaguely aware of the Silk Roads. And David became my PhD supervisor, very generously became my supervisor. And with David, I worked intently on ancient Central Asian civilizations, such as the Parthians and the Kushans. But then one day David said, look, you might be interested in teaching this really wacky course I've got going. It's called Big History. And, of course, I had no idea what Big History was. So David said, come along to a lecture. I need a new teaching assistant, and I think you might be just the man. So I went to a lecture, And I think it was on The Origins of Power, The Evolution of Power in Early Human Societies. And I was hooked straight away. I thought, wow, this is tremendously interesting. Even this one lecture is combining sort of psychology, sociology, early human history, and so on. So I said, David, I would love to do it. And so he took me under his wing and sort of trained me up, and I became his teaching assistant at Macquarie. But that's in two ways, David changed my life. I just want to make that clear. Mm-hmm. He firstly introduced me to this great ancient Central Asian civilization of the Kushans that were so important in facilitating Silk Roads exchanges. And through that, I became something of a Kushan specialist. Then that other sentence, I teach this wacky thing called Big History. I'd like you to come along and be my teaching assistant. And so through those two sentences from David Christian, my life just completely changed. And so I taught them with David for a few years. David, then, while I was completing my PhD, David then went off to San Diego State University in the United States to teach Big History. A colleague of David's took over the course, Marnie Hughes Warrington. I worked with Marnie for a few years. And then when the opportunity came for me to move to the United States, I did so. And I've been teaching Big History for 13 years now at my university here in Michigan. So that's about 21 years, which makes me, I guess, one of the sort of accidental pioneers. I wouldn't be here if David hadn't invited me into the fold. And let me just tell you something briefly about how David came up with this idea.
Yeah.
So David was asked to design a general education history class at Macquarie University in Sydney for non-history majors. And he was sort of the junior member of the faculty, so he got the job of coming up with, what his colleagues were imagining would be a typical world history survey course. But the more David thought about it, the more he thought, I can't start just with the origins of civilization and writing 5,000 years ago. That's leaving out huge eons of human history. At the very least, I want to go back to the agricultural revolution. And he thought, but that's no good either. I need to go back to the emergence of Homo sapiens, the Paleolithic era. And then he said, but of course, Homo sapiens are just one of 30-odd hominid species we're aware of, so perhaps I should begin with the origins of hominids. And you can see how he kept pushing himself further back. And after sort of a week of – maybe a couple of weeks of soul-searching, he came back to his department and said, look, I've got it all worked out, chaps. I'm going to start my course with the Big Bang. And, of course, his colleagues thought he'd gone crazy. Like, what? You're a modern historian, Christian, and you're going to start with the Big Bang. But he convinced them. And very quickly, this course became the most popular general education course at Macquarie University, with hundreds of students pouring in to sort of, relish the value of a genuinely interdisciplinary approach to knowledge, and also to see a place in this story where all of their majors and all of their hopes for the future fit. Mm-hmm. So David was vindicated almost immediately. That course has been taught at Macquarie ever since, I guess it was about 1989 when it first started. Mm-hmm. And so that's David now sort of the doyen, if you like, still the great master of Big History. But those of us who were fortunate enough to come under his influence early on have now also sort of gained the mantle of pioneers of Big History.
That's very interesting. I'll have to get back to that in just a second. His origins as a gen ed class, that makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. But to continue with this semi-autobiographical segment. So in a way, this is a conspiracy formed around David Christian and Macquarie University. How did it begin to spread beyond that? And there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, all great schools of thought have begun like that, right? I mean,
sure.
How did it begin to spread beyond Macquarie and so on?
Sure, Al. Well, actually, that's sort of interesting too and quite coincidental. As David began to teach this, he realized that there were a handful of other places around the world where other individual scholars or individual professors were trying something vaguely similar. So he became aware in a couple of years of some efforts in the Netherlands, at the University of Amsterdam, particularly by Fred Speer, to teach something similar. He became aware of Eric Chasson at Harvard and Tufts University, an astrophysicist who was doing something similar from a sort of quantum physics point of view. A couple of other places too, in Russia. Coincidentally, there are a couple of colleagues there trying something similar, sort of an all-embracing macro history course. And this was sort of well ensconced in the School of Global Studies at Moscow State University. But again, just one or two people doing this. John Mears at Southern Methodist University in Texas was doing something vaguely similar. So although David sort of is credited certainly with coming up with the term Big History and being the first to sort of fully articulate what this school could mean, David would be the last one to claim exclusive credit for this. So as he became aware, of course, he reached out. David's a very friendly guy, reached out and made connections with these other colleagues, and gradually this network began to form. And then others of us, such as myself, that came in, you know, a little bit later, became part of this sort of expanding network. And it continued, I guess it continued under the radar. So a lot of us who've been teaching it as a gen ed course, and again, we can come back to that, were teaching it sort of as a general history 101, the sort of course that students would sign up for to satisfy their historical perspectives, you know, gen ed credits. And they would walk in, for example, they walk into my class at Grand Valley State and go, whoa, what's this? Because my course was just one of 14 different sections of 101 that we were offering.
Right.
But this was the only one that was beginning with the origins of the universe and how stars were formed and so on. And increasingly became aware that, you know, it's a shame we're having to teach this in sort of disguise as something else. Wouldn't it be great if we could start to promote this as a genuine field? And so that's when the idea came about that we should try and form a professional association. And people such as Barry Rodrigue at Southern Maine University, another pioneer of Big History, and Walter Alvarez, a superb geologist at Berkeley University, California, they said, you know, all this sort of agitation and discussion was going on. But then Walter was the catalyst. Walter invited about a dozen of us to a geological research institute in the Apennine Mountains in Italy back in 2011. And there we basically, you know, us non-geologists learned how to be a geologist from one of the world's leading geologists. So that was an incredible experience. And we sat around at the end of that thing and said, look, why don't we form the International Big History Association? And very, very fortunately, some folks were there from Microsoft Research because they were very interested in a timeline tool, a zoomable timeline tool that some of Walter's students were coming up with at Berkeley, and also a representative of sort of Bill Gates more generally was there. And these colleagues very generously said to us, look, we might be able to give you a little bit of money, but that would help get this association going. So we formally constituted the association in February 2011, and that's given, you know, now that there's a formal association that everyone can belong to, that's given a tremendous boost to the field more generally. And there's one other aspect of this I should mention, if I'm not going on too long.
No, keep on, keep on.
And that is that I mentioned Bill Gates now. Bill Gates became very interested in Big History when a friend of his sent him a copy of some DVD lectures that David Christian had made for the teaching company.
Yes, those are excellent lectures, and we'll link to those in our notes, by the way. You can all enjoy David Christian's Big History lecture for a small price. Just in time for Christmas.
It's a perfect Christmas gift. Yeah. So Bill Gates, from what I've never met Bill Gates, but David has several times. From what I understand, he's a lifelong learner. Actually, someone I suggest my students could sort of model themselves on. And likes to stay fit, likes to run on his running machine regularly, and watches a lecture basically every morning. You know, someone sent him David's series. He said, this is a fantastic idea. He got in touch with David, and he said, I realize how this fits very well into college-level general education sort of curriculum, but I think this would be a superb high school course, particularly pitched at 9th and 10th grade students. And with your permission, I want to put together a team of web designers, of pedagogy specialists, of content specialists and so on, and create an online version of this for high school students. And then when it's done, I want to release it free to the world. And true to his word, he did that. He invested a lot of money. That incredible course was released last year. Mm-hmm. Your listeners can certainly just Google the Big History Project and they'll find all these resources.
Right.
And it's a superb Big History course. And because of that, there are now thousands of schools all around the world where Big History is being taught.
We'll link to that in the show notes. It's bighistoryproject.com for those of you who can't wait.
Right.
And you can even get a sticker at the end of completing the course, which is better than you get from listening to Historically Thinking. We should give out stickers or buttons. Anyways, let's move back then a little bit, and let's hear the 20-minute version of Big History. Now, on the bighistoryproject.com, when David Christian gives a lecture, we should mention that probably another explosion of interest came from the now famous TED Talk that he gave, which probably has, you know, 18 million downloads or something like that.
Yeah, that's a good point, Alan. That was that was part of the Big History Project team's sort of marketing ideas, you know, that Bill Gates brought together just really superb people. And one of the things they said early on was, we need to do a TED Talk about this. And it's a fabulous TED Talk. David is a very eloquent speaker, as I'm sure you've seen. But the production value is there too. You know, he's got a great team of web people, you know, web designers working with him. So, yeah. But please, listeners, check out David talking on Big History on TED.
It was it's brilliant. He's one of the 2 out of 100 professors history professors that really should be allowed to lecture. probably, yeah. He divides the big history into thresholds. That sort of seems to be one of your first terms of art. What do you mean by threshold?
Yeah, let's just think about that for a moment. And by the way, there's a textbook also available in Big History called Big History Between Nothing and Everything that I had the pleasure of co-authoring with David Christian and another dear colleague, Cynthia Brown, from Dominican University in California. By the way, Dominican University in California makes Big History the required course for all their incoming first-year students. They see it as the quintessential general education, liberal education course. So every first-year student takes Big History there. Just one of the a bit of a shout-out there for the superb work that colleagues at Dominican University are doing in the Bay Area. So when we thought about this textbook, and we're thinking about the textbook for several years before the Big History Project came along, we thought, you know, what's an organizing principle? How can we sort of divide this up? To be honest, we're also somewhat pragmatic. We're thinking, well, you know, Big History is generally taught as a one semester, so 14-week course to first-year university students. That's where it's been housed, you know, around the world for many years now. So let's have basically 13 chapters and an introduction to help professors, you know, to help instructors sort of have some organization there. But beyond that, this has been an idea that David's had, and I think it's valid, that the universe in its 13.82 billion years of history has crossed several thresholds of complexity. That is, we see conditions building up to such an extent that something profoundly different appears, something far more complex appears. This can be the first stars, for example. This can be the more complex elements that are created by supernovae. Planets appear. That's clearly another threshold. Life appearing in the universe. Universe has crossed another threshold of complexity. So it's, and once it crosses this threshold, it's like a whole new, the game begins almost all over again. And so we can then apply, and these sort of new properties emerge at each of these thresholds, these emergent properties that go on to sort of create conditions for the next threshold to be crossed. You can apply this to human history too. Only in a few places on the planet will we see sufficient conditions build up to allow human communities to make the transition from hunter foraging, hunter gathering to agriculture, for example. Only in a handful of geological, geographical environments will we see early towns evolving into cities, states appearing, and so on. So these sort of these stages of complexity can be applied both to at the cosmic level, the planetary level, biological, and even the human history level. So, you know, thinking about that and sort of trying to cut it down to a manageable number, we said, well, maybe there's about 8, right? The first of these, of course, is the appearance of the universe itself.
The Big Bang.
The Big Bang. So we have no idea what there was before the Big Bang. We have no idea what caused the Big Bang. As you pointed out in your introduction, we've got this sort of tiny subatomic particle of sort of seething with energy and density and so on. And it suddenly begins to inflate. And where there was nothing, suddenly there's a universe. Right, it's tiny, but it's rapidly expanding, and essentially all the matter and energy that will ever exist in the universe are there in that sort of embryonic seed, if you like, the primordial seed. So that's clearly the first threshold. Now, of course, that's not to say that there aren't multiple universes out there, as string theory would articulate. That's not to say that there isn't a parent universe and our universe is just one.
But we can't prove that string theory anyway, so don't worry about it.
We can't prove any of those theories, of course. So anyway, that would be the first threshold, right? This universe appears 13.82 billion years ago. It rapidly inflates, and about 380,000 years after the appearance of the universe, temperatures cool sufficiently to allow the first stable atoms to form. That will make up the two simplest elements in the universe, hydrogen with one proton, helium with two protons. At that moment, by the way, there's a huge release of energy, cosmic background radiation, which will later be detected in the 1960s. by Penzias and Wilson. Accidentally, they find this thing. This becomes one of the crucial pieces of evidence to support the Big Bang Theory. So the universe sort of continues to expand. Within maybe 200 to 400 million years after the Big Bang, the first stars form. This is clearly another level of complexity because this is the next threshold. Suddenly we've got different objects, new and interesting objects. These huge balls of sort of nuclear fusion, right, of hydrogen being converted to helium at incredible temperatures, 10 million degrees Celsius or hotter. And some of these stars get very, very big indeed. And when these massive stars finally die, right, they live fast, they die young, they explode in this sort of vast cataclysmic eruption we call a supernova. And it's in the death of giant stars, and particularly supernova, that all the other elements of the periodic table are cooked up.
And that's threshold three.
That's threshold three. And by the way, ask most chemistry majors at your university, where did all the more complex elements in the universe come from? And even most chemistry majors have got no real idea. This is like, it's one of the fundamental facts of science, which is, I mean, they can quote all the elements. They know how they bond with each other and so on, and compound. But to me, that's one of the most extraordinary facts of science, right? Mm-hmm. That everything that exists in the universe, with the exception of hydrogen and helium, and weird stuff we don't understand, like dark. Yeah.
So let me just stop you there. I mean, that's an example of how this is an interesting example. This is answering one of my questions, like, why should I bother? Why should I bother as a historian to do this? You've just given an example of how chemistry, physics students would be helpful for them to think historically.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've got very good science colleagues, and many of them come into my course as specialists, and they are superb teachers. But a lot of science colleagues, I think, don't teach the majesty, the mystery, the awesomeness of these scientific discoveries. Mm-hmm. If you're taking a chemistry course or a physics course, you know, understandably, you've got to learn the basics of that discipline, of course. But a lot of students find it, I don't know, needlessly dry, at least early on. Like, how do we know this stuff? Where do these elements come from? Who first discovered this? You know, this is extraordinary stuff. Mm-hmm. And for me, the excitement of science can be lost. Not always. I don't want to generalize. I'm sure there are many great science professors out there doing a superb job teaching the awesome story here. But most students will get that in something like a history of science course, right? That's where they're sort of going to get these discoveries more. Mm-hmm. So threshold three, critically important. And, you know, Joni Mitchell sang a song back in the 60s. I'm sure you're aware.
Yeah,
Woodstock. We are stardust, we are golden, we are billion-year-old carbon. You know, here's Joni sort of putting that into a superb popular song, more or less at the very moment that these discoveries are being made. You know, that was cutting-edge science back in the 60s to be saying that. So that's extraordinary.
Threshold four.
Threshold four then, eventually in certain, again, in the right environment, certain specific environments, clouds of matter come together. Clouds of matter that obviously consist a lot of hydrogen and helium, but all the other stuff that was made in a supernova. So this happens in the sort of the neighborhood where there's been a supernova. This huge cloud comes together, a huge solar nebula, begins to spin and compress. Gravity's going to work. It condenses the center of this cloud, gets hotter and hotter and hotter, and eventually another star will ignite. In this case, our own sun, right, as we think about our own solar system. And 99.9% of all the material in that cloud ends up in the sun. But the little tiny bit that's left over gets sort of trapped in orbit around the sun. Think of the material in the rings of Jupiter as an example of this, right? Mm-hmm. Then massive collisions occur and bits stick together and through accretion. And eventually you're left with a handful of planets, each to its own orbit, circling around this star, around this sun. And, of course, one planet, the third rock from the sun, the appearance of that planet in particular is the next threshold. Right. An extraordinary planet full of all the complex elements that have been created by a supernova.
So that's threshold five, then, if I count correctly. Life on Earth?
I think four. Hang on, let me go back now. Now you're going to test me. Now you're going to show me that I haven't read my own textbook for a little while. Four, five, six. Maybe that's four or five. I'll think back to that in just a minute. The appearance of the planet certainly is another major threshold. I think that's four still.
It is still four. Threshold five is life on Earth.
Correct. So then you've got a planet that we know is about 4.5 billion years old, formed at the same time as the sun. We know lots of other stuff about it. We know how the moon was formed. We know that there was a huge sort of melting of the planet through differentiation. A lot of the heavy material sank to the middle. So we've got this hot iron metallic core, which creates the magnetic field, which is so important for so many reasons. Then we've got this very thick mantle and then the crust and so on. And we also know there was a late bombardment of meteors bringing a lot of iron. So that's why we have a lot of iron on the surface that we can access. Perhaps also bringing a lot of frozen comets, bringing water to the planet. Anyway, eventually the planet goes through sort of a very hellish phase early on, the Hadean epoch. Then things settle down. And very quickly, life begins to appear on our planet. And that's clearly, you've got a, here's a sort of rock floating in space. Nothing is living on it. And from at least 3.8 billion years ago, and perhaps 4.1 billion years ago, based on some very recent discoveries, organic material appears. Much discussion about whether some of it may have been brought here from space, again, on meteors or comets. But biology has got a very coherent story of how simple organic chemicals essentially morphed, evolved into the building blocks of life, into amino acids and phospholipids and so on, how these things began to link up to form big chains of matter. They form cellular walls. And eventually we have archaebacteria, single-cell organisms, probably first appearing beside volcanic fissures deep under the ocean, feeding on the heat and energy coming out from the inside the planet. So the appearance of life, clearly the fifth threshold. And then the history of life, fascinating in just a few seconds. Some of these archaebacteria float to the surface. They access the energy from the sun. They begin to photosynthesize. They change the chemical composition of the atmosphere. And over billions of years of single cellular sort of evolution, all this coalesces into this extraordinary Cambrian explosion of multicellular life about 600 million years ago. And then some life colonizes the surface of the planet, insects, trees, eventually reptiles and so on. And then, you know, we could go on here, but right, dinosaurs, right. Dinosaur extinction and the appearance of the rise of the mammals and eventually the appearance of hominids.
So only now in threshold six do we get to what historians like to call prehistory. Which is where David Christian was thinking of beginning. Now, let me just interject a question here.
Sure,
why bother to go all the way back to the Big Bang? I mean, why? I mean, I can now, I have to say, from a general ed perspective, this all makes now perfect sense.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a great general ed course. It's fantastic. It combines mm-hmm. everything. It reunites historical studies, human studies, and scientific studies in a really interesting and fantastic way. Mm-hmm. But from a historian's perspective, I mean, not just from a teacher's perspective, why bother?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And we're all specialist historians still. So I still do, you know, most of my publications in ancient Central Asia and nomadic migration, the Silk Roads, you know. So it's not that we've abandoned our sort of interest in sort of pure history as well, which we have.
Mm-hmm.
But for it, I guess the argument would be, you mentioned I'm president of the World History Association, so I'm a real advocate for world history as well. And the argument would be, I think, that just as the field of history has gained much from the approach of world historians who have been able to sort of find a place for all the specialized historical studies that historians have traditionally done and put them into a larger narrative of the story of humans on this planet, right? And I think, you know, in a way that sort of complements both the large scale and the small scale, which says these are both important. And we need the small-scale work of specialized historians to understand this larger narrative of world history. So I think the field of history has gained much from world history, and I remember very well how much pushback there was from specialized historians against world history early on.
Yeah,
this is amateurish, this is dilettantish, this is way too general, and you know, you're trying to supplant the work of real historians. Of course, now maybe 30, 35 years later, world history is a very respected approach, which, as I say, complements the work of specialized historians. So in the same way, I think we could say that not just history, but all these other disciplines that we've been mentioning can have much to gain through seeing their perspectives embedded in this much larger story. So I guess what I'm saying is this transcends the discipline of history. To me, this is the universal narrative in which all disciplines find a place, in which the work of specialists in all disciplines is validated, and which helps humans understand their past, their present, and their future in a way that's not possible, right, without this large sort of story. So I think it's transcending history in a way, the traditional approach of historians. But again, none of this makes sense, right? If it wasn't for the fact that some of my colleagues spend their entire life studying fairly obscure coins of ancient Central Asian civilizations or long-lost sort of inscriptions of ancient languages and so on, we couldn't tell the story of the Silk Roads, for example, right? And here, if we didn't have historians or anthropologists doing the work of, you know, studying the sort of Paleolithic era of human history and but also historians of the Americas, you know, the ancient and the sort of modern Americas. We couldn't tell this story with the same sort of richness of detail. But to be honest with you, I feel like when I'm a big historian, I've left the field of history behind somewhat and am trying to use as many disciplines as possible to tell this story. Mm-hmm. Probably not a very good explanation.
Well, I'm going to get back to some of that stuff in just a minute. Let's move on to then threshold six, collective learning.
Yeah, collective learning. So when eventually out of this mix of hominids, you know, we know 32, 33, heck, in this semester alone, I think there's been at least two, if not three more discoveries of different hominid species.
Yeah.
That's another both exciting and daunting aspect of big history. Barely a day goes by that something isn't coming up to sort of alter the story somehow, you know, mm-hmm. to change the detail. But out of that, eventually humans appear, Homo sapiens appear about 200 to 250,000 years ago as yet another evolutionary experiment in the sort of this great radiation of hominids. Early Homo sapiens, for whatever reason, have got particular wiring in the brain, including the FOXP2 gene and Broca's area and so on, these sort of specialized nodes that allow for more complex speech, complex language. And this language gives humans the ability to communicate in a far more specific, sort of also abstract, symbolic way than the language of any other hominid species that we're aware of, right, was able to do. And the two advantages this gives us is that we can share information with a degree of precision that seems impossible for any other species. And furthermore, we use language to store this information in our collective memory. So collective learning means our species can learn not just from each other, but from all the knowledge that previous generations have acquired. And one analogy we use in the textbook, it's as though every other hominid is sort of a standalone computer, but humans alone are networked. So you and I are members of a network of, you know, 2 billion humans. And frankly, you and I, through our cell phones or this computer I'm using now, mm-hmm. can access every piece of information that every one of those humans has ever acquired. And your students and my students are standing on the shoulders of maybe 100 billion humans who've come before us. And again, through their technology, through our technology, they can access everything that every human has ever found out before them, right? It must be this collective learning ability that's given us this edge that's allowed us uniquely to shape the planet in a way that no other species could even imagine. So that's the best way we can come up to describe the unique abilities of humans, right? Because clearly we are. I mean, evolution shows we're so like all other large animals. Clearly we're products of Darwinian evolution in every way. And one of the skills that evolved in us was this complex language ability, and that's led to collective learning.
Threshold seven is, in fact, an outgrowth of that collective learning. It's agriculture, in which we begin to find ways of storing away a massive amounts of calories and thereby, in fact, alter our physiology. So take it away.
Yeah, and that's a great point, Al. I mean, so for 200,000 years, we lived very successfully as hunter-gatherers. We live in small communities. Collective learning is going on, but it's not on a very sort of large scale because we must keep our group small. You know, we're constantly nomadic. Nonetheless, and during the height of the last ice age, we migrate all over the world. We settle on every single continent except Antarctica. So we're very good at adapting to different environments. You know, heck, we migrate to Siberia 40,000 years ago at the height of the last ice age. I mean, because we can design tools and clothing and ice dwellings and so on to do that. You know? So, I mean, collective learning is clearly going on. But then everything changes in a few small places around 11,000 years ago. Just a handful of places, actually, some groups of humans make this transition from nomadic foraging to sedentary agriculture. You know, historians have long been aware of that, and there were many, many theories about why that happened. The current explanation seems to be that the end of the last ice age created very benign environmental conditions in a few places, like the Fertile Crescent, for example. And this allowed hunter-gatherers to settle down in one place. And they're still hunter-gathering, but they're staying in one place. And as soon as they became sedentary, populations began to increase quite rapidly. There were more and more mouths to feed. There was less and less room to hunt and gather. There were groups living all around you now. And humans were basically trapped through sedentism into having to work with the plants and animals that they were used to working with, you know, as foragers, mm-hmm. and essentially domesticate them.
But we found out that
it wasn't a choice. It was a trap somehow that they found themselves.
But we found out that in the process that grain is a great repository of caloric value, nutritional value. And domesticating those things that we had been using, turning them into pastoral animals. We were able to use dairy. People moved from lactose to lactose tolerance, at least in Northern Europe. And the genetic changes we're now discovering that go on with this as well.
Sure, absolutely.
People get taller. They get stronger than they had been before.
Of course, Al, this doesn't happen all at once. In fact, initially, the decision to move to agriculture seemed like a bad idea, where bioarchaeologists can compare the bones of early farmers with hunter-gatherers. Mm-hmm. You know, initially we get shorter, our bones are more brittle, it's a more stressful existence.
Right.
We're utterly dependent on a handful of species now, whereas when you're a nomadic forager, you've got plenty of other options always. So, and the Australian Aboriginals, for example, explicitly rejected the transition to farming. They saw it going on in the islands of the north of Australia and said, that looks like too much work on me, mate, and did not adopt it. But you're right, over several thousands of years, we increase our caloric intake. We domesticate, you know, powerful wild animals like the aurochs and the mouflon and turn them into sort of fairly pathetic domestic sort of species. Mm-hmm. And populations increase, villages become towns, the first cities appear, you know, in the Fertile Crescent, then Egypt, then Indus Valley and Huanghe, Yangtze, and so on. You know the story. And the first civilizations appear, as we call it, well, however you want to define civilizations, empires and so on. None of that would have happened. Writing, warfare, hierarchies, patriarchy.
Historians.
Yeah, historians. Yeah. None of that would have happened if these small groups hadn't made this transition. So clearly this is a huge threshold, right?
And finally, threshold 8, modern revolution.
Yeah, because then very little changes for the next, say, 10,000 years. You know, we do see these great civilizations appear and monumental architecture and warfare and all that really fascinating, cool stuff. I'm actually, if I can do a plug right now, I'm writing my second series for the teaching company. I have one out there called The Foundations of Eastern Civilization, which is a 48-lecture series on East Asian history. I'm doing one right now called The Big History of Civilizations, 36 lectures. That's looking at these links between the environment, between geological history, biological history, and human history. So we do see these extraordinary sort of civilizations appear and so on. But then it all changes again about 250 years ago with industrialization. And from that moment on, it marks the change is registered in massive population growth. The population of the human species in the year 1900 was about 1.6 billion. 100 years later, it was 6 billion. Mm-hmm. A fourfold increase in one century after 250,000 years of human history. Think of the unparalleled assault on the environment that occurred as a result of that. Think of the extraordinary rate of technological change that occurred because of that. The modern revolution, we are living in profoundly different times to humans just a couple of hundred years ago. They would barely recognize this world now. So that's clearly another major threshold. And that's the eighth and thus far final threshold. Although, of course, we have a lot of fun speculating about the future.
Mm-hmm. So that's our rapid-fire schematic of big history. And what I'm curious, as I've been thinking about this, is to what extent is big history an attempt to more reflect morally on the human past?
Mm.
I don't know if you're familiar with David Harlan's Degradation of American History, which is not just about, it's about the American historical profession more than just mm-hmm. American history. Harlan's, in that book, attempted from a rather, from around the bend of the postmodern turn, he attempted to restore moral reflection to the study of history. I think looking around, probably unsuccessfully. Listening to David Christian, reading him, listening to you, it seems to me that from a very different direction, from, shall I say, almost a philosophically materialist position, you guys are also trying to restore some level of moral reflection. David Christian, in his now famous TED Talk, discusses the Cuban Missile Crisis and feeling that, you know, the human organism was about to be destroyed at that moment, and that big history should give us some sort of pause. It would give us a moral pause. That's a very interesting claim, I think. Not many historians would make that for their type of history.
Yes, this is actually a really tricky thing to talk about, because even within the Big History Association, there are quite divergent points of view on this. Some would argue that big history is simply providing the material, right, for individuals to then use to make some sort of moral, construct some sort of moral meaning or message out of it. And some big historians explicitly reject the use of big history to sort of tell, I don't know, impart a moral message. Others of us, I mean, so the argument would be that big history is nothing more than, say, it's a tool that humans have devised. It's like knowledge of chemistry or like GPS, right? That that different humans can use this tool. In other words, the factual recounting of the story of the universe and of humans' place in it to construct whatever meaning they want, but that the role of big historians is not to construct that meaning and to explicitly reject attempts to do so, right? Mm-hmm. So you've just actually touched upon a very challenging and quite contentious discussion within the field of big history. So I've got to be careful what I say here.
Well, you're speaking for yourself, not for the...
I'm not speaking on behalf of the International Big History Association.
Understood.
For me, certainly, I mean, you see this, it's sort of almost Carl Sagan-ish in a sense. You see this extraordinary story playing out. You see these bitter divisions, these dreadful conflicts. You see untold misery heaped by one group of humans upon another group of humans as we share this small rock, you know, this only sort of lifeboat Earth that we have, and we're prepared to sort of tear ourselves apart over some ridiculous ideology or some ridiculous disagreement over social life or the fact that America's lost its moral compass, whatever the heck that means, which is, I'm hearing trumpeted all the time right now. So for me, clearly there's a moral story here. Look at the extraordinary circumstances that have led to us even being here discussing this right now. This series of sort of random occurrences, right, that our planet happened to form where there'd been a supernova. So we had all these materials available, that we were just the right distance from the sun and so on for liquid water to form, that life happened to evolve here, that the dinosaurs went extinct 65 million years ago because of this massive, you know, asteroid impact that allowed tiny shrew-like mammals to sort of survive and prosper. And eventually, as Darwin showed us, this has led to us, you know. So the series of extraordinary cosmic, geological, biological freak circumstances and mutations has led to us being here right now. And we have to realize that we share a common commitment, that we share a common responsibility to care for each other, to care for this planet. So if big history teaches us anything, it's you have a role to play now in writing the next part of this story. This is particularly true for students, right, for our students now. Right? So here you are equipped with this story now. You're about to leave university, go out, become leaders, influence the world around you in a way that few others are equipped to do because you know the whole story. You know how lucky we are to be here, right? So what can you do to write the next chapter? And I do think students leave a big history course more than any other history course or perhaps any other disciplinary course at all with a real sense of their responsibilities to sort of do what they can to write a threshold 9, which is a huge improvement on where we are right now.
So we've gone from not that long ago, you and I both remember being preached to about being suspicious of the meta-narrative. And now, really, you guys have come up with sort of the ultimate meta-narrative.
You're right, Al. And, you know, I have enormous respect for postmodernists and postmodernist critique. There are some postmodernists actually in the Big History Association who offer very valuable critique
I don't know how they could be members, but go on.
No, it does seem counterintuitive, but, you know, genuine postmodernists argue that any narrative that we construct is inherently false, it's flawed, it's the narrative constructed by people like me, by white Australian academics and so on. It's a narrative to sort of ensure our own power or maintenance of power, and you know the arguments of postmodernism, that there is nothing coherent in the past, that all that exists is this series of human lives that add up to nothing. It's like, is it Thomas Walken, You Can't Go Home Again, I think. Seeing these series of tiny bursts of light. There's a human life, it's come and gone. Like, I think he's riffing on Goethe at that stage. These lights, there's no pattern, they don't add up to anything. Let's just celebrate the utter meaninglessness of human existence. Let's not try and make sense of it, right? That's wrong. But, you know, look at the creation stories that humans have created from the beginning of our species, be that the oral dreamtime stories of the Aboriginals or Native American creation stories or the Bible, the Quran, the Hindu accounts, whatever, right? Humans need these narratives. People need to make sense of how they fit into this universe, right? And of how everything was made and how we were made and where we might be going and what's my role and my responsibility in this story. So our argument is let's give them the best, most objective, most up-to-date, non-biased as much as possible, objective account that we can, then humans can use that, you know, to answer these questions, but also to hopefully construct a more moral future, construct a better future in some way. It's hard to articulate.
My guest today has been Craig Benjamin. He is the Associate Professor of History at Grand Valley State University and a member of the International Big History Association. Craig, this has been fantastic. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Al, it's been a real pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
For more historical thinking, go to historicallythinking.org, where you can comment on today's program and find show notes, links, and readings related to today's conversation. Historically Thinking is recorded in the studio of WAUG, the student radio station of Augustana College. Our program's editor is John Ruddat. Beth Leimbach keeps the schedules in sync. Matt Lejas keeps WAUG studio running. I'm your host, Al Zambon. Talk to you next week.